1996 immigration law and gave the INS so many laws to enforce. What do you say to that? I mean,
that's true. This is an old topic that's coming back around. You're absolutely right. And the commission that looked at this in the mid-90s, that it didn't result in legislation, and even legislation that was introduced in the last Congress never went anywhere, quite frankly. There hasn't been the outcry from the public and the political will, quite frankly, of both parties to move legislation forward. What there had been, particularly in the mid-90s, that was the height of the backlash, if you will, against immigrants, much of which started in California with the passage of Proposition 187, and then Governor Pete Wilson really trying to save his political career on the backs of undocumented immigrants. And that led, as you mentioned, to the passage of three very, very harsh, restrictive pieces of legislation in 1996. And it really did just dump a lot more responsibility on the INS and did not give it the resources commensurate with the responsibility to enforce those laws or to implement the service side of those laws adequately. Now, you know, September 11th, quite frankly, has brought this debate into much sharper focus. And certainly the debacle after September 11th, where two of the hijackers' visas were extended, and other missteps by the INS have created, if you will, the space for this debate to happen. It's happened very quickly in the House. I think the Senate process will be a bit more deliberative, but you've got a very engaged, the two chambers, the House and Senate, as well as the administration, watching this closely.
We're going to go now. We're going to try to talk to Maria Jimenez from the American Friends Service Committee, because she's very involved in the activism side on the impact on real people's lives beyond the INS, the splitting up of the agency. There was a pretty big impact. There is a pretty big impact of 9/11 and its aftermath mm-hmm. on the lives of immigrants. Mm-hmm. Initially, it was said that the administration said that immigrants would not be blamed for what happened, but some of the steps taken by the government in the anti-terrorism fight have greatly impacted them, especially Latino immigrants. For example, the first thing that happened was the whole discussion between the governments of Mexico and the United States about a possible legalization plan for undocumented Mexican workers was completely halted, and the whole debate was turned upside down. With us to talk about that impact is Maria Jimenez from the American Friends Service Committee. Welcome, Maria.
Well, thank you very much.
But what has been some of this practical impact on people's lives?
Well, I think, first of all, I just want to quickly comment, as Angela pointed out, that the issue of restructuring of the INS is really not an immigrant demand. Whether it's one INS, two, three, four, however the administrative aspect of it goes, I think for the immigrant community, the basic issues are quality services, which there aren't at this moment. Secondly, the second issue is, of course, treatment with dignity and protection of rights, both in offices as well as in enforcement practices. And the third is accountability in terms of the ability of the general public to hold any employee or officer of the INS accountable for improper actions. And I think that's important to say, because, again, whether it's one, three, or four, or five might preoccupy whoever wants to make the government more streamlined, but the preoccupation of the immigrant community is that no matter how they restructure it, that those three things are accomplished by whatever reorganization results. And that's important because the impact is so dramatic after 9/11 on the community. Definitely the enforcement branch has tremendously grown. The INS is the largest federal law enforcement agency in the country at the moment, with the largest budget, with the greatest number of agents. Information is being shared now with the National Center for the National Crime Information Center, and so that puts many immigrants who basically were able to remain in the United States a target for local police to arrest them, and of course the amount of immigration enforcement activities, like the arrests at the LA airport and others that have been reported around the country, has dramatically increased, as well as the presence, which was already very very high, of Border Patrol agents on the southern border. So all of these things together basically gives us a very strong emphasis on enforcement. Whether this will change because they make it one or two agencies is not really a matter of how the INS carries out its work. It's really a matter of national policy and the way the Congress sees the issue of migration, and they look at it as a law enforcement problem, and a, particularly a domestic law enforcement problem. And so they tend to, like most complex problems, say, well, if we just put more cops on the street, this will be solved. If we put more Border Patrol agents, we'll deal with this issue of migration, which is unrealistic and has been unrealistic in the approach. But the impact on the community is tremendous because it does lead to instability in the community, and it leads to fear, and it leads to a rollback in terms of a participation within society in a way that would be meaningful for people and for the U.S. society.
And also with us here on the line is somebody who represents immigrants in their fight to stay legal in this country. Carl Schusterman is an attorney, is a lawyer in private practice specializing in immigration and nationality law. And also, very specially, he worked for the INS between the years of 76 and 82, and he knows the agency pretty well. Welcome to the show, Carl.
Welcome, Pilar. I'm glad to be talking to you. You've already revealed my little secret.
Yeah. Why don't you tell us about some of the cases, or how can we figure out what the specific impact of this whole after 9/11 situation with regular people that come to you to wanted to immigrate to this country?
Yeah. I know when I actually worked for the Immigration Service, which, as you pointed out, was in the last century, about 25 years ago, I started a program where they had attorneys actually interviewing people who wanted to naturalize as U.S. citizens. And the first school that I went out to talk to their citizenship class was Roosevelt Adult School, which is in Boyle Heights, east of downtown Los Angeles. And one of the things I was curious about is that at that time, and this was, you know, in the late 1970s, why the naturalization rates for people from Mexico were so low. I mean, much lower than people from Philippines or Vietnam or something like that. And most of the people in the class, when I asked them, they all said the same thing. They said, well, you know, when you go into that immigration building, even though you're applying to become a citizen, you're never sure that you may not leave except by a green bus. You know, they may drop you off on the other side of the border. And even though that sounds a little bit facetious, it's not. Just this week, one of my recent clients was a critical care nurse from one of our major hospitals. And she's been living in the United States about 15 years, has grown kids who are permanent residents. Her husband's a permanent resident. He's a religious leader, in fact. She came in to get her naturalization after all these years, and she admitted very candidly that when she first came to the United States, she was picked up a couple of times for shoplifting, and she's very embarrassed about it, but she did reveal it on the application, and she's very proud of how she's turned her life around. The immigration examiner immediately started to ask her if she had a drug problem or if she was selling drugs, denied her application for naturalization on the grounds that she was under deportation proceedings. She was only under deportation proceedings because that examiner had his boss put her under deportation proceedings while she was sitting there for the naturalization interview, and she came to me, and now we'll probably have to spend the next couple of years defending her, hopefully successfully. I'm quite confident about her case that when it gets before an immigration judge, she will win. But you know, it just goes to show that, you know, having this mix of benefits on one side and enforcement on the other side, especially when the agency is really largely driven by the enforcement people. The district directors of the local office are by and large all enforcement background people. The money that people pay for their fees to be naturalized and so on, a lot of it is siphoned into enforcement. And, you know, because of this type of story, which is not unusual, we do need a split in the agency. We need a different attitude. We need a different split. We need a lot of things.
Angela, I know you have to leave us, but do you have any last comments?
Well, I really appreciate that you're bringing up this very important issue, because I think it's, you know, it's a subset of a much bigger question, and that is what is the nation's attitude towards immigrants? You know, it tends to shift given whatever the mood is at the time, and certainly post September 11th, it's been particularly trying and difficult. But to, you know, to end on sort of a positive note, I have to say that I think that as a nation that we can be both a nation of laws and a nation of immigrants. And there have been several just extreme restrictionist voices that have been very much muted in particularly in Congress. And so unlike what we saw in the mid-90s, Congress has actually been able to be much more the adult branch of government and not pass some of the most excessive and extreme laws that we had feared that they might, the way we saw them do in the mid-90s. Where I think there is a lot of room for concern, quite frankly, is with the Department of Justice, where you have seen, and I think your intro leading up to our introduction explained that so clearly, that there have been just excessive actions by the Department of Justice, very much targeting the Middle Eastern community, but now with a much broader brush. The idea of deputizing state and local law enforcement and being able to enforce civil immigration laws is going to strike terror in the hearts of the immigrant community. And it really is a wake-up call, I think, to your listeners and quite frankly to the president, who, you know, on the one hand talks about the warm embrace of our neighbors to the south and of immigrants and speaks with some pride about it, but on the other hand has an attorney general that really seems quite focused on alienating the immigrant community, I think much to the peril of this administration. So I think it's a challenging time, and we see signs of hope, we see signs of challenge, and I think the INS restructuring chapter is really just chapter one.
Thank you so much, Angela.
Thank you. Have a nice evening. Bye-bye.
Thank you. This is Pilar Marrero hosting Beneath the Surface on KPFK 90.7 FM. We are discussing immigration policy with guests Angela Kelly, who's just left us, Carl Schusterman, and Maria Jimenez. We'll be back after this short break.
Has progressive politics become captive to its imagery? That's the subject for discussion this week on Deadline LA. Join me, Barbara Osborne, at 7 p.m. right here on KPFK.
So what really happened in Jenin? Israeli Defense Forces claimed that about 200 people were killed, but later retracted their statement. Palestinians have found 58 bodies, which so far matches the Israeli figure. Since the UN's fact-finding mission has been derailed, does Israel have anything to hide? I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. Tune in to the morning show on Monday, the 6th of May at 7 a.m., where representatives of Human Rights Watch and Amnesty International shed light on Jenin. Also, Adam Shapiro in studio. LA Times' Paul Watson reporting live from the Pakistan-Afghanistan frontier. California's love affair with SUVs. And Enron employee turns activist. Can you believe all the things we have in store for you? At the morning show, Monday from 7 a.m. to 9 a.m. on 90.7 FM KPFK.
Hi, welcome back to Beneath the Surface. This is Pilar Marrero, and we're talking about how immigration policy has changed after September 11. And we're still talking to Carl Schusterman. He's an attorney specializing in immigration law, and to Maria Jimenez with the Americans Friends Service Committee. to Maria or to Carl, either of you who wants to answer this question. There's been a lot of reports of immigration raids all over the place, but basically what we've had lately has been a targeted operation of workers at the airport. There's been about 200 people detained for having no papers or no legal papers or having lied in their applications. Many were undocumented or legal. Some of them were legal residents, especially because after the law, the Patriot Act was passed, only citizens can take these jobs. But these are jobs that pay very low wages, because such as the airline screening and others, they pay close to the minimum wage. But none of these workers have been tied in any way to terrorist organizations. Why is this going to help anti-terrorism? Maria?
Yeah, that's the point I think that Angela was making, that it won't. I mean, there has been an attitude in terms of the implementation of a different enforcement, not only operations, but strategies such as deputizing local police that is coming from the Department of Justice under the concept of homeland security, which from the point of view of even from the point of view of homeland security is counterproductive, because if, for instance, in the case of local police, deputizing local police to arrest someone because of immigration violations will simply make people reluctant to report people they know are engaged in criminal activities for fear of being deported. So if and it's more likely that if local police aren't involved, that is one agency that persons can go to report, for instance, in the case they know of someone engaging in or preparing a terrorist threat. So it's really a very counterproductive, but again, I think what we have just begun to see is how in the name of Homeland Security, all of these policies are being extended, and how they are impacting, dramatically the day-to-day routine lives of many immigrant communities.
Carl, you were telling me a couple of days ago that there's other programs that have been shut down after September 11. Like the doctors, remember the doctors?
Yes, okay, yes. The medical doctors come to the United States for training from all over the world, particularly from countries like India and the Philippines and some of the Eastern European countries. And these doctors do their residencies primarily in places like County Hospital and, you know, USC County Hospital in Los Angeles and Cook County in Chicago, Henry Ford in Detroit. Basically, the large county hospitals cannot run without these immigrant residents. These are the, you know, when you say doctor, you're probably seeing somebody who is a doctor trained in a foreign country and is doing their residency in the United States. But most of these people are on a type of visa that they have to go home for 2 years after they finish their residencies, or the government has been very successful for years. Agencies like the Department of Housing and Urban Development and the Department of Agriculture sponsoring these physicians, if they're willing to work in underserved areas of the United States for 3 years, they don't have to go back home. And the government really doesn't have any other program to replace these doctors if they're not sponsored to go to the underserved areas. Well, one of the agencies created a huge commotion right after 9/11, the Department of Agriculture, which has sponsored over 3,000 of these physicians in the last 8 years, suddenly stopped approving physicians, and then in February announced that they were going to cut the whole program because they were worried about the physicians themselves, that they couldn't do adequate security checks upon those physicians. I think that their reason was not that they couldn't do adequate security, because all they're doing is recommending to the State Department and the Immigration Service that these doctors not have to go home for 2 years, and those agencies have always done the security checks. I think the Department of Agriculture was just looking for a way out of this program because they get no funding for the program. But you can see that 9/11's had a tremendous impact, because on their website and on their press releases, They blamed everything on security and everything on 9/11. And you know, to me, it seems a little ridiculous. In the weeks after 9/11, there were a lot of news reports about anthrax. People are worried and should be worried about things like bioterrorism. And unless we have enough doctors and, you know, nurses is, I think, the other subject we talked about at our major hospitals, we're actually more vulnerable to terrorism instead of less vulnerable.
Yes. Maria, at first after the attacks, it seemed like many of the pro-immigrant activist organizations took a long time to start speaking out forcefully about things that were happening. And some still aren't doing it. Because of this whole sentiment that if you criticize the government, you are going to be labeled as a traitor or a terrorist sympathizer. Is that something that you felt?
Well, I think the immediate reaction was to reflect as to how we were going to proceed. And most of us had been heavily engaged in the fight for legalization of the undocumented. And so the first reaction, I think, was to try to conserve the organizing and the people's participation up to that point instead of disbanding it or losing it. So we entered into a period, I think, of reflection and reorganization. In many cases, continued to work on training, et cetera, to increase better participation in civically. But we didn't stop in terms of actual defense work. Some have, but I see even immigrants themselves willing to participate in different activities which are happening, like the May 1st events, which took place in about 40 cities in the United States, and in which, again, it was a sort of a way of saying, we're here to stay, you need to legalize our situation. And we're not the terrorists, we're the victims of terrorism. And in first the people who died in the towers, but then secondly with all of these policies that are really creating very complex and difficult situations for immigrant families. So I think it was rather than a silence for the fear of the government doing something to anyone, it was rather a moment of reflection and reorganization and trying to conserve what we had. Now, in practice, there have been some people arrested. For instance, a very strong immigrant leader in Minnesota, Mireles Jimenez, was arrested coming out of a meeting. And then, of course, we have the incidents in San Diego, and we have other incidents here in Texas. But I think, in general, that hasn't been a reason not to participate. If anything, it's the reason not to participate deals more with the increased possibility that one can be arrested, not for that activity, not for participating or defending, but for the many things that we've talked to before, the many types of different strategies of enforcement that are being conducted at different levels. In terms of homeland security.
Maria, before this happened, we were very close to having some kind of legalization program. There were high-level talks between Mexico and the United States. Both governments seemed to be very interested in this. And that, of course, has temporarily stopped after September 11. When do you think this will reappear as an issue? Or will it?
Well, for the immigrant community, as I said, we started again May the 1st in terms of a coordinated effort nationally. And there were people in D.C. Visiting Capitol Hill. There was a meeting with the White House, et cetera. For the immigrant community in the United States, you might say May the 1st was the formal announcement of we're here and we're going to continue. As for the government, that, I think, is more complex. And that has been a criticism, I think, of both government, the unwillingness to be pursued by the White House, but also the unwillingness to press on behalf of the Mexican government. For instance, there were several of us who went to Monterrey expecting a guest worker program, but it didn't even get to that. They simply announced border security measures between both governments. And, and interestingly enough, for Mexican immigrants, it wasn't about the security of Mexico, because anyone knows who has traveled into Mexico that all the checkpoints that are being conducted by the Mexican military and coordinated agencies of Mexican, several levels of Mexican police, are not checking people going into Mexico, but people going out of Mexico. So again, it's tied into U.S. interest, and this is why I think the Senate of Mexico was upset and tried to hold the Fox administration accountable for its lack of initiative in pursuing this issue after 9/11 by the Senate of Mexico denying him leaving the country until they were better informed as to what plans the Fox administration had.
Maria, we're running out of time. I want Carl to talk a little bit about some of the changes and also for visitors and students. There's been some changes announced by the government.
Some really drastic and, frankly, very unfocused changes that are proposed to limit terrorism, but probably the terrorists would be the least affected by these changes of anybody in the country. They really should call this the Muhammad Atta regulations, because of what happened in March when 6 months after September 11th, Muhammad Atta's school was informed that he had been granted a student visa, you know, months before. The immigration commissioner took a lot of heat from Congress about, you know, what the hell's wrong with this agency? Why are they granting? I mean, it came out in the paper that they were granting a visa to a terrorist even after he died. That's how screwed up they were. So as a consequence of that, the INS really felt like they had to do something dramatic. And what they did is they've proposed a set of regulations to restrict how long a tourist can stay in the United States. So where your typical tourist may be, we have millions of immigrants in the United States who have family members that are abroad. So let's say, you know, you have somebody from a country quite far away, let's say from India, you know, the person's a computer programmer and husband and wife with a couple small kids, and their parents are going to come to the United States and probably spend thousands of dollars to get over here and so on. They probably have to save money for a couple of years, where before the Immigration Service would give them 6 months and plus a possibility of an extension to stay in the U.S. as a tourist. Now they're proposing it to limit to a much shorter period. Probably the default is going to be 30 days. And then almost impossible to get an extension outside of a extreme medical emergency after that. And, you know, the idea that, and by the way, this used to be how the Immigration Service operated back when, 25 years ago when I was in the Immigration Service. And about 10 years ago, somebody got smart and said, gee, you know, we're letting people in for 30 days or 60 days, and the whole agency is swamped just with applications for extension of stay in the United States. Why don't we just give people 6 months, and then there'll be a lot fewer applications?
Yeah.
We can devote ourselves to things like, you know,
Carl, we're running out of time.
Okay.
I'm so sorry.
Yeah, so I think we're going backwards, unfortunately.
That will do for this installment of Beneath the Surface. My name is Pilar Marrero. I am the political editor of La Opinión. I want to thank our guests, Carl Schusterman, immigration attorney, and Maria Jimenez from the American Friends Service Committee. I'd like to thank also my engineer, Maggie Lepic, and my producers, Dan Pavlish and George Hoglan. Stay tuned next for the KPFK Evening News, and thank you for listening.
The KPFK Evening News is next on 90.7 FM KPFK Los Angeles. Also listen at 98.7 FM in Santa Barbara County. LA's Reporters Roundtable Deadline LA is coming up at 7 o'clock with Barbara Osborne. Her topic is, has progressive politics become captive to its imagery? That's at 7 o'clock tonight on Deadline LA. Listen on the web at kpfk.org.
Today on Latino USA, Latino gangs in Los Angeles.